The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, The Timekeeper of Ukraine. The world's time to which all clocks are set comes from small national labs. Ukraine's is in Kharkiv, a city under fire. This is written by Nate Hopper. For 6 years, Vladimir Soldatov has been the custodian of Ukraine's time. He oversees a laboratory in the city of Kharkiv that contains about a dozen clocks and several distributive devices, gray boxes humming in gray racks and connected via looping cables that together create, count, and communicate his country's seconds. The lab is located in the Institute of Metrology, a cluster of cream-colored buildings now scarred by Russian artillery. Soldatov is Ukraine's representative in a small international community of obsessives who keep their nation's time and by doing so help construct the world's time, to which all clocks are set. Kharkiv has endured waves of bombardment since Russia invaded Ukraine on February 24, 2022. During that first winter, an explosion about 50 meters from Soldatov's lab shattered all of its windows and spiked its herringbone wooden floors with shards of glass. Most of the lab's devices kept ticking. The windows are now filled with wood and insulation, and Soldatov and his colleagues have moved many of their instruments from second and third floor rooms to a basement space, Soldatov explained to me by email, in case the building is hit directly again. Modern timekeeping is a science of nearly unfathomable precision, based on counting the perfectly steady, rapidly recurring undulations of energy waves. An energy wave rises, peaks, descends, bottoms out, ascends, and returns to its original altitude. Tick. The wave repeats the same motion at the same pace, taking the same interval of time to complete the cycle. Tick. The trick for timekeepers is to ensure they all use the waves that oscillate at the same rate, the same frequency. Since 1967, when timekeepers officially forsook astronomy for physics as the basis of the second, the time's definitional energy wave has been one that, when it hits a cesium-133 atom that is in one of two energy states, inspires the atom to switch to the other. This change is called a clock transition. To find that frequency, a cesium clock embarks on a continuous search. It uses magnets or lasers to select only the atoms that are in one of those two states, beams them through a pair of energy fields, and notes how many atoms make the leap. The clock then adjusts the frequency of the field's energy and sends another batch of atoms through, repeating this process over and over, nearing, then overshooting, then nearing, then overshooting the frequency. The clock determines the frequency of energy that seems to convert the most atoms, then counts its undulations. For these measurements to be as accurate as possible, timekeepers have to sustain a stable environment around the atoms, both in the lab and within the clocks, which are also known as standards. Some timekeeping labs keep their temperature constant within tenths of a degree Celsius. The clocks have their own internal temperature stabilizers, as well as vacuums that remove excess atoms and molecules, and shields to fend off energy waves that could distort their readings. The need to control for every variable can hardly be overstated, because the second is arguably civilization's most precisely defined unit of measurement. Ideally, each second should contain 9,192,631,770 ticks of the definitional frequency. Not all atomic clocks use cesium. In the Kharkiv lab, three clocks do. 6 use hydrogen, which can be more stable in the short term, and several use rubidium, though none in the latter contribute to Ukraine's time. Today, that is the job of 2 cesium and 2 hydrogen clocks. Another hydrogen clock operates in reserve. Soldatov previously kept 4 reserves running, but that would require more electricity than he can currently use. Of his work, Soldatov told me, mostly I have to repair the old Soviet hydrogen standards. Sometimes he has to disassemble devices to adjust their inner sanctum, often using spare parts. And, he added, the cesium standard doesn't like it when a rocket explodes 50 meters away. That early blast tore off the side walls of several hydrogen clocks, badly bending them, but they kept running. The cesium clock closest to the wall, though, stopped transmitting its time to the measuring system. Soldatov shut it down. When he started it back up, it lagged behind the other clocks. He restarted it again, under the manufacturer's advice, but then it rushed. He tried again. For a while, it seemed to operate normally, but then it began performing too poorly to keep running. Under ordinary circumstances, all clocks accelerate or decelerate at their own rate. Even atomic ones made to the exact same specifications will deviate from one another. Partly for this reason, timekeeping labs generally use a weighted average of their clock's readings, called a time scale, as their time. The world's central time scale, called Coordinated Universal Time, or UTC, is based on the weighted average of more than 400 clocks in about 70 labs across the world. A 7-person department within the International Bureau of Weights and Measures in the Paris suburb of Sèvres calculates this average. One country's time is seldom in sync with another's. Even when they do coincide, they don't remain that way for long. But the best timekeeping labs tend to steer their time to keep within a couple of nanoseconds of UTC. Others stay within hundreds or thousands. Soldatov has generally kept Ukraine's time within about 20 nanoseconds. At the beginning of the war, around the time the blast shattered the Institute's windows, Ukraine's time rose to more than 65 billionths of a second fast and stayed there for about 10 days before recovering. "I had no time to monitor the scale," Soldatov said. In another period, when the city went without power for several days, the hydrogen standards had to be shut off to conserve energy. The lab's latest differences for a 5-day interval between July 28th and August 27th have ranged from 38 billionths of a second fast to 2.1 slow. Soldatov is 46 years old, grew up in Kharkiv, and graduated from its Air Force University with a degree in radio engineering. "I became the custodian somewhat by chance," he wrote to me. After serving in the Army for 10 years, he worked as a programmer and built websites. "A friend invited me to set up computers and write a program for a frequency synthesizer for the system, and after some time, I became the head of the laboratory." When the Russians began bombing Kharkiv, Soldatov directed most of the laboratory's staff to stay at home. One colleague remained with him to keep the time, Demian Mykolaevich Kravchenko, an engineer who moved with his family into the Institute's subterranean bomb shelter within days of the Russian incursion to escape the relentless shelling of their neighborhood. A time relies on having someone to look after it. If the lab's clocks do not operate continuously, the time will be lost. Many timekeepers swear that the devices wait until nights or weekends to malfunction. "It may sound funny, but I treat my system as a living organism," Soldatov joked. He thinks of his instruments as temperamental colleagues, some of whose components are not much younger than he is. They harbor a furtive mischief. If a staff member leaves the laboratory, something breaks. "I can't explain it, but it happens." In the early days of the war, the Russians bombed the city mainly at night. Soldatov often stayed overnight at the Institute to tend to the standards, and especially to keep an eye on the generator if the power went out. But the Russians changed their patterns, according to Soldatov, first to random times within the city's curfew, but then to any time, including during the day and in crowded places, due to the great efficiency and the desire of the Russian Federation to kill as many people as possible. One Sunday morning, Kravchenko was in the Institute's back area when a cluster bomb hit. He was killed in front of his family, Soldatov told me. Soldatov had spoken with Kravchenko at the Institute just hours before. For many months afterwards, Soldatov kept Ukraine's time alone. Now he has a staff again, and he works remotely, except when the devices need to be reset or repaired, when he comes in to develop devices for the future. In recent weeks, Russia has redoubled its attacks on Kharkiv, raising a question that I put to Soldatov. What would happen if Ukraine's primary timekeeping lab were destroyed? What if a national time suddenly disappeared? His response was sobering. We have not conducted experiments to determine what would happen if a single point of synchronization fails, he wrote. But it is highly likely that achieving high-speed internet and stable communication will be impossible. Timekeeping may be delicate, but it is also resilient, because its burden is distributed and shared. Critical infrastructure all over the world relies on numerous clocks in far-flung places to remain synchronized within millions of a second. Power grids, for instance, use temporal alignment to pinpoint failures. But a grid's clocks don't need to be synchronized to UTC or even to a national lab. They need simply to be synchronized to one another. Many telecommunication providers around the world operate similarly. Their networks need to stay synchronized to connect calls across towers. They often do so using GPS receivers and clocks. Exactly how and to what time Ukrainian telecoms companies synchronize is so essential to their functioning that three of the country's providers declined to provide their timekeeping systems to me. A representative of LifeCell responded to my query. The information you are requesting is quite sensitive and cannot be disclosed, especially during the war. The Institute of Metrology is linked directly to the Internet. Soldatov's lab houses two servers that distribute Ukrainian time to anyone who wants it. Together, they receive about 250,000 requests for the time a day, sometimes many more, Soldatov said. Because these servers are connected to a primary time source, they are at the top of the Internet's temporal hierarchy, or on Stratum 1. Beneath them, on Stratum 2, are go-between servers that pass their understanding of the time along to other servers and machines. And so the time trickles through the web, often synchronous within tens of milliseconds, down to the innumerable devices that sustain the Internet, and degrading as it goes to the corners of the screens of the public's personal computers. This system was designed in the earliest days of the Internet when network devices failed frequently. It's based on principles that are fundamental to timekeeping, redundancy, and diversity. Coders have often been surprised by how complex time can be. Once in a while, a leap second must be added to UTC to keep the time mostly aligned with the Earth's erratic rotation. When this happens, websites and digital systems have been known to fail because of a gap of a single second. Without sources of time like the lab in Ukraine, improperly programmed systems would swiftly drift at least a second out of sync. Encrypted systems would especially suffer, as they require a particularly large amount of synchronous data to operate. Websites could break, or at least slow. In Ukraine, rolling blackouts already limit the hours that people can spend online communicating, working, or reading. Losing a primary central time source could cause an additional disturbance to Internet access across the nation. The country's handful of surviving Stratum 1 servers could be flooded with requests. Whether they would be overwhelmed or hold steady is not known. Ukraine does have a lesser backup timescale in Kyiv, and the Ukrainian military has its own standards. But if the Kharkiv lab were destroyed, Ukraine would almost certainly depend on more than ever on GPS for the time. The country's Stratum 1 servers outside the lab use it as their time source, just as the power grid does. In a 2019 paper, Soldatov warned against Ukraine's reliance on GPS for the time. According to some experts, our dependence on GPS is becoming very dangerous. Given the extreme unreliability of this technology, he wrote, the problem is that the signal from the satellite is very weak, and it is extremely easy to muffle it with generating noise at the same frequency. The war has made GPS even harder to access in Ukraine. Soldatov does not believe that the war will destroy his lab's timescale, but he has suffered other losses since it began. A rocket badly damaged his family's home, so he, his wife, and his teenage son now live with his mother in a small apartment a few kilometers from the lab. Recently, one of the hydrogen standards just went out, Soldatov wrote to me. That same day, the daughter of a colleague called me and said her father had died. This colleague had worked specifically on that device. Soldatov once saw his work as being central to Ukraine's technological ascendance and an indicator of technical potential. He wrote, the better the clock in the country, the more developed it is, as a rule, the more data it can process. But he has come to believe that Ukraine's potential is withering. Yes, sometimes it seems to me that all my work is meaningless and has few prospects, and I want to go somewhere far away and do my own thing. But for now, I am where I am. Soldatov learned in the military to value perseverance and responsibility over self-preservation, he told me, and he thinks that most of Kharkiv's residents share this mentality. If the clocks are destroyed, he wrote, I will go to serve on the front lines. Next, Why Helene Caught So Many Residents Off Guard, by Laura Kelly. This was written on October 3rd and updated on October 4th. Western North Carolina lies hundreds of miles inland from any coast. The counties around the Blue Ridge Mountains sit at high elevations, away from the dense flood zones across the Atlantic. The idea that more than a foot of rain would rapidly overwhelm the region, sweeping up homes and ripping up vegetation, seemed almost unthinkable. But a week after Hurricane Helene made landfall, at least 200 people have died, and the death toll is expected to rise as the floodwaters recede and the debris clears. Many inland residents of North Carolina have never experienced flooding like this in their lifetime, and only a sliver of them have the flood insurance necessary to help them rebuild. Flood insurance isn't included in homeowners insurance, and Americans are generally not required to buy it. Without this special coverage, floods can be a huge financial shock to households. Carolyn Kowski, the Associate Vice President for Economics and Policy at the Environmental Defense Fund, told me, those living in storm-torn areas without coverage are looking at a massive list of expenses, home repairs, debris removal, temporary lodging, that they may have to pay for out of pocket after Helene. Still, just a tiny share of homeowners currently own flood insurance. Most of the North Carolina counties hit hard by Helene did not fall within high-risk areas on flood maps. One estimate found that less than 2.5% of homeowners in the region have flood insurance, and that number is even lower in some counties. In a perfect world, everyone with some degree of flood risk could and would buy flood insurance on their homes. My colleague Zoe Schlanger, who covers climate change, told me. But the reality is that some of the residents in flood-prone areas do not buy the plans because they are so expensive. The average premium cost $700 a year in 2019, but that number can reach thousands for some local coastal communities. Lower-income residents face an especially daunting situation. they are less likely to be able to afford flood insurance, and they also have less money on hand to rebuild. Many people assume that they face little risk if they aren't living in an area included in high risk zones on FEMA's flood maps. Sarah Prawley, a political science professor at Maxwell School at Syracuse University, told me, but FEMA's maps don't capture the full picture of flood risk. They are drawn based on the assumption that the past will help us predict the future. In a rapidly changing climate, that's not the case. The maps can quickly become outdated as climate risks evolve, she noted, and don't take into account pluvial flooding or flooding from heavy rain events, which is what North Carolina saw. Even people who have personally experienced flooding sometimes drop their policy, Prawley said, adding that if people have lived in a place where it hasn't flooded in decades, they lose that memory of what can happen and what kind of losses they might suffer. Those who do buy flood insurance usually live in areas prone to flooding. The result is a system in which the risk is not evenly spread out, making flood insurance premiums hugely pricey. Prawley likens it to a health insurance system in which only the sick buy coverage. Some counties organize their disaster insurance programs so everyone pays a flat rate, Kowski exclaimed. In the United States, that would mean someone living on Florida's coastline would pay the same premium as someone living on the top of a mountain. That's a tough sell for many Americans, and overhauling the national flood insurance program, which is saddled with debt, would be politically contentious. The process of recovering from Helene is just beginning. Still, hurricane season is not over for the rest of the country, and FEMA currently does not have enough funding to make it through the rest of the season. Last week, President Joe Biden signed a short-term spending bill authorizing another $16 billion for the agency, but further funding would need to come from Congress, which is currently in recess until after the election. So much of the response following disasters can feel piecemeal and reactive, Prawley says. The insurance is important, but not the full story. Every dollar we put into prevention is going to have to be a lot more efficiently spent, she explained. In a world reshaped by climate change, this idea that there's safe places you can go hide is unrealistic. Our third story, The Hero Gen Z Needs, by Elise Hannum. Snoopy was everywhere when I was growing up in the early 2000s. On TV, the cartoon beagle appeared as a float in a Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade and starred in the holiday specials my family watched. In real life, his statues were all over St. Paul, Minnesota, a hometown I share with the Peanuts creator Charles Schulz. After I left for college, Snoopy largely disappeared from my life. But recently, I've started encountering him all over again on social media. This online resurgence, primarily among young people, has mostly been fueled by short, shareable Peanuts clips set to surprisingly apt contemporary music. In them, Charlie Brown's intrepid pet beagle tags along on the kids' adventures. They often face some sort of problem, but aren't always left with an easy solution. Sometimes Snoopy is a help, and sometimes he's a hindrance. Other times he's on his own adventures. Regardless, Snoopy has always been defined in part by how emotional he is. Some fans say that his personality speaks to their inner child. It seems that a new generation is finally seeing Snoopy for who he really is. Despite featuring an adorable dog in his rich family life, Peanuts always had bleak philosophical themes. In the early years of the strip, which ran in 1950, cultural critics called Schulz a pop existentialist, according to Blake Scott Ball, a history professor at Huntington College and the author of Charlie Brown's America, The Popular Politics of Peanuts. The comic was about the difficulty of existing as a regular human being in the 20th century, just how hard it is to handle the immensity of problems that faced us, and hold all that together with your daily concerns, Ball told me. Schultz posed serious questions in his stories about armed conflict, for example, in the era of acute atomic bomb fears and the beginning of the Vietnam War, but left the answers unclear. In one scene, Snoopy wears his aviator outfit and compares being trapped in his doghouse to being imprisoned. Snoopy, despite his broad imagination and silly antics, had personal troubles too. Paul pointed to one edition of Peanuts where Snoopy cries on Mother's Day because he's separated from his mom. After helping him send her a card, Charlie Brown muses how holidays can be difficult for everyone. When Schultz adapted his comics for the animated specials in the 1960s, Snoopy became more anthropomorphic and expressive and then embarked on his own fantastical B-plots. He didn't speak, instead communicating with noises, including whining and cackling. Still, his angst remained. Many of today's young people likely first experienced the Peanuts characters through the animated specials, which explain why those clips trigger a specific nostalgia. But the televised format also lends itself to TikTok. Unlike in the comics, Snoopy in animated form doesn't have thought bubbles to explain his feelings, so he resorts to over-the-top physicality. When a female poodle pecks him on the cheek, he blushes, his ears standing straight up, then falls into a swoon as cartoon hearts appear over his head. He sobs loudly at a party, but still taking comfort from a small moment of affection, a high five with a friend. His ability to convey these sentiments, all without saying a word, might have a particular appeal for Zoomers, who have been performing big emotions online since they learned to type. In Sarah Boxer's 2015 Atlantic article on Snoopy's legacy, she describes his behavior as a defense mechanism. Since no one will ever see you the way you see yourself, you might as well build up your world around fantasy, create the person you want to be, and live it out, live it up. As Zoomers come of age, they face a barrage of seemingly hopeless climate and political catastrophes. In the face of this, it's no wonder Snoopy has become a hero. Sometimes people just want to throw up their hands at the immensity of the world and retreat to a controlled interior one, a doghouse of their own, from which they can feel their emotions as much as they want. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.